Okay, tonight we're doing the parsha of Nitzavim and Vayelech. It's a double parsha, the two little parshas, they put them together. We're going to be focusing on a piece in the second parsha of Vayelech, dealing with the mitzvah of Hakel, which we'll talk about the Grand Assembly. But we're going to start with a little video action. Let's go to the videotape.
Had a great time wishing these NFL players well as they headed out on the field. Eli Boddy is just two, but he's already a proud Detroit Lions fan. He's also a good sport. When he and his dad went to see their team play the Tennessee Titans, Eli caught the visiting team coming down the tunnel and wished them a good game with high fives. Then he almost got carried onto the field. Titans linebacker Wesley Woodyard picked Eli up and shared a moment with the child. Eli's dad took this video, which is going viral on Facebook. That wasn't all. During the game, tight end Delaney Walker also handed Eli a football he just scored a touchdown with. While his parents say this Michigan boy is still a Lions fan, he'll always have a special place in his heart for the Titans, who showed him so much love.
I'm Mara. All right. So, all right. I got a. Okay. So, did everybody see the sheet in the screen?
Yes.
Good. All right. Simple. I have a series of questions. So basically, this two-year-old two-year-old was taken to this Detroit Lions game, and the cute little video with him saying, you know, I don't know how they got access to this, but to get to say hello, the Tennessee Titans or Texas Titans. No, one of this. And give him a high five. So let me ask you a simple question. Can a two-year-old understand football?
Of course not.
Of course not.
I think he can understand the idea of winning and losing, but all the little minutiae details that go into a football game, no.
Right. So the little guy, yes. So I would agree with that. So that brings, of course, bears the question. Now, I don't know if anybody here has gone to a professional football game in New York, in America, tickets are routinely over $100 per seat. Okay? So why would a parent spend, why is a parent spending money to bring him to a professional football game if the child cannot possibly understand what's going on?
The atmosphere and the experience.
Okay, to what end? What is his father presumably trying to accomplish?
I'm assuming the father is a pretty big Lions fan, so he wants his son to also be a Lions fan. And then as the child grows up, it becomes a father-son bonding thing to watch the games together, to cheer for the team together, and to have that time together.
So even at age two,
you start them young.
So what, how is the, so what do you think the two-year-old is going to gain from the experience?
I think this is a metaphor to maybe the synagogue and shul. And it could be two ways. It could be like you want to expose your kids from a young age to a specific way. Like people think of sports of like, you know, people get really crazy about sports. Or it could be a metaphor for people who only go to shul on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur and don't really know what's going on, and they buy tickets. So I think it could be either one.
So they want to. All right. So those are some those are helpful metaphorical interpretations. But why is the person bringing the? But I'm just trying to say what is the parent trying to hope to accomplish by bringing the child there, age two?
I look forward to going to the stadium. I like being with daddy, and I like doing this with them. That's the end, what you hope for.
Right. Right. Also, there, what the child can experience is the, you know, the spectacle of the color, of the sounds, of getting, of course, the treats, the hot dog, the popcorn. Are these all these experiential dimensions, even though that the, he can't really follow the game, and he's going to look around when, you know, he'll figure out, oh, this is a time to, oh, yeah! You know, this is a time to boo, even though that he doesn't really understand what's going on. And, of course, the father's only investing in taking him to the, you know, to the Detroit Lions game because it's not that he's going to do it just a one-time shot in age two, but he's going to take him when he's three, and he's four, and he's five, and he's 10. And as Shayna pointed out, he can develop an entire bond. So it'll be a central feature of their relationship. In other words, it'll be sort of the center of their emotional solar system will be the sharing of the fan experience, the football experience. And of course, we're such an in America, we're such a sports-focused or obsessed culture. Seeing this is you'll see a multi, you know, before a classic football game. What do you see before the game?
The tailgating.
Right, and how are people dressed?
In their team jerseys or team colors.
Team jerseys, at least that's a team jersey is the minimum. Plus the team hat, you know, appropriate hat, and you're having multi members of the family join together, and that you know they do the they make it into like a pre barbecue before the game, getting all together, and they watch the game, and they all sit together, and it becomes a central focus of a familial bonding experience. Okay, and they're trying to build a sort of a family tradition, and the day has a sort of like it's like a personal avoda, a service. In other words,
by the way, just to interrupt, college football is mamish a family tradition like this for generations in the South and the Carolinas and the Midwest. College football every Saturday is like that. It's really a generational thing.
And it's not limited to college football. Is that specifically if you have a great affiliation to your home team, and especially if you went to that
grandparents, the alumni, the whole ganze mishpucha.
Right. So it's extremely and it's a very intense experience. And like to not join in is looked at what? To not participate. Let's say one kid says, I don't really like football. What is that town? What is that equal to? Anybody? Am I the only person living in America? I don't think so.
It's frowned upon.
It's avodah zarah.
Well, okay, I don't know about going to idolatry, but it's viewed as sort of like a betrayal. This is the family tradition. Right. We every Sunday during football season we're going. We have a tailgate party. We wear the jerseys. We talk about the game incessantly. We're having l'chaims, the equivalent of l'chaims before and during. It's a whole thing. All right.
You get kind of ostracized too.
Yeah, you'll be you're basically it's a betrayal from the values of the family. Okay. All right. This is a helpful. Precursor to what I'm going to do is we've been doing the last couple sessions is I'm going to have you guys look at the psukim yourself to read it to yourselves, and I'm going to pause the recording, and allow you to look at the psukim. I'll make it a little bigger, and then we'll rejoin. So I'll give you guys 5 minutes to look at the psukim yourselves. All right. So what's happening in this this part of the narrative? Who could summarize it in their own words?
They're about to go into Israel. Yep. Moshe's preparing Yehoshua to be the leader.
Yep.
And he's dictating to them what they're going to do after they go into Israel.
Okay, good. True. Okay. And then well, he's been actually doing that for some time already, because in a certain sense, that's the entire book of Devarim. The entire book of Deuteronomy, the fifth book of the Torah, is really Moshe's final address, covering the last 6 weeks of his life. So really, your description could apply to the entire book. So what's happening here? What does he do?
In the first part, Moses tells Joshua that when they go into the land of Israel, Joshua will be the one to parcel out the land. And then in the second part, you have Moses writing the Torah, giving it to the descendants of Levi. And then the laws or a commandment about when they're going to read it.
Okay, good. So Moshe writes down the Torah. Now, one question, what's a question you can ask, an obvious question?
Why do they have to read it at this one select time?
Why do they have to read it at this time? That's okay. Good question. What else? But I'm saying specifically back to verse 9.
What does it mean that he wrote down this Torah?
Okay.
We know it was written down. We have it. Why do we need to be told he wrote it?
Okay. What else? What else? I'll give you a little hint. Is the Torah over?
No.
No.
So the most basic question, he's writing the Torah, but the Torah does not seem to be ending here. So, all right. There seems to be an additional 3 chapters.
But we know the Torah isn't chronological, so okay. This could be the end.
Okay. I didn't say there wasn't an answer, Moshe Chaim. I'm just saying that you want to be critical in your reading there. So that's good.
That's my critical response.
And I like that critical. And not only is that your critical response, it's even the Ibn Ezra's critical solution as well. Okay. Now, why is he introducing if the reading of the writing down of the Torah is not going to be until the end of the, till actually on the day he dies, okay, finishing off the final copy over there, then why is he mentioning it over here?
Because of the connection between the transfer of leadership and the completion of the Torah?
Well, what's that?
That if the Jewish people are getting a new leader, then they have to be true to not only to him, but to what, but to the Torah that Moshe is giving him.
Okay, so he gives them, correct. So you have Yehoshua getting the, Moshua is becoming being transitioned into leadership, A. And then B, the book is been handed to the Kohanim, okay, the elders, the leadership, which is basically the guidebook of how he's supposed to run the state, run the society. But there's also an additional reason is that he's now, now let's get into this special mitzvah. This is, if you were paying attention, this is the 612th mitzvah if you go by the order of the Parshiot. 612 out of the 613. What is this mitzvah? Who can describe this mitzvah in your own words? Right there in, Suzanne, describe this mitzvah. What is this mitzvah?
I'm going to go with you have to hear a reading of the Torah.
Okay. When?
At the end of the 7-year cycle.
Okay. After Jubilee.
Right. Okay. After.
Well, after Shemitah.
Yeah, after the Shemitah. And a public place.
It says when all the Israel comes to present itself before God your Lord in the place that he will choose. What is that a code for? What? What is that?
I'm going to go with the Beis HaMikdash.
Beis HaMikdash, correct. Square, you're correct. All right.
And it could also be any of the Shalosh Regalim.
He does. Which Regal is it talking about in specific?
Sukkot.
Right. So all the Jews. So it's basically the first major holiday right after the beginning of the new cycle. They finished the 7th year of the Shemitah cycle. They're starting, let's call it year 8 or year 1. And the first big holiday to get together is called Sukkot, and they're supposed to, and they have to gather to the Beit Hamikdash anyways for the 3 festivals, right? And they have to hear the Torah, okay?
From the king.
Well, it doesn't say that. Doesn't say that over here, right? You must read from this Torah before all Israel so that they will hear it. Doesn't tell you who's doing the reading. There's an oral law. We'll get to that, but. But what's the goal?
The leader should be the lead teacher.
Well, they're not meeting every time. This seems to be a one-shot deal. They're doing this every 7 years.
To get everybody involved, I think. Okay. To get those who don't know to listen. Together.
Men, women, and children, and the converts from all your communities, they have to hear it. And it says openly, they will thus learn to be in awe of God your Lord, carefully keeping your words of this Torah. And then we have verse 13, their children who do not know will listen and learn to be in awe of Hashem, Lord your God, as long as you live in the land which you are crossing the Jordan to occupy. So the question, all right. So what really are they trying to create?
A communal Torah experience.
Yes. Which communal Torah, what, name me a famous communal Torah experience in the Torah.
The receiving of the Torah on Har Sinai.
Correct, for 500 points in the square. So what really are we doing here?
Recreating the receiving of the Torah?
100% correct. To what end? To what goal?
To the goal of connecting the tradition that we see every 7 years. This has been going. Why are we doing this? Because our grandparents did it, and they did it because they did it. And we're not just because of that, but the presence of today that we're directly connecting to the Torah and to the, you know, the Ma'amad Har Sinai, to the...
But it actually says the goal. We don't have to, you know, it says, so thus they learn to be in awe of God, your Lord, carefully keeping all the words of the Torah, and their children who do not know will listen and learn to be in awe of the law of God, your Lord, as long as you live in the land which you're crossing the Jordan to occupy. So the stated goal, which we have to see how, is to have a, what they call awe of God. The Hebrew of that is Yirat Hashem, fear or awe of God. A. Yep. And B, the second idea being the mitzvot, to reinvigorate their connection to the commandments. Now, why is this a good vehicle of doing that? What do you say? Why is it a good way of doing that? All right, let's hold off that question. We're going to go quickly. You guys are going to read for me. We're going to do a couple of the halachot.
Hey, Rapidi, what's your question? What's the difference between virtual reality and real reality?
No, I didn't say no. The question is, what are they trying to accomplish? In other words, why is this mitzvah the best way to accomplish this goal of fear of God and connecting to the Mets vote.
Can I ask a question that would help?
I mean, let's take Pesach by Seder, for example. I mean, there it's just a zikr, right? It's a remembrance of the leaving of Egypt, and we're trying to reenact it for ourselves, right? That right. we're going. So what, you know, what's better than an experience, a real experience?
Okay, so we're gonna flush that out. All right, Moshe Chaim, what do you got?
Why connect this to the beginning of the Shemitah cycle as opposed to every year when everyone's supposed to be at the Beit HaMikdash anyway?
That's an excellent question. Well, I hope to answer that question. Remind me at the end, or better yet, you'll answer it if I'm successful. All right, so let's have some reading here. Who would like to read? Nah Chaim is driving. We're going to have Shana.
It is a positive commandment to gather together the entire Jewish people, men, women, and children, after every sabbatical year when they ascend for the pilgrimage holiday, and to read so that they hear passages from the Torah that encourage them to perform mitzvot and strengthen them in the true faith. As Deuteronomy states, at the end of a seven-year period, at the time of the sabbatical year on the Sukkot holiday, when all Israel come to appear, gather the nation, the men, the women, the children, and your stranger in your gates.
Okay, so it's a positive commandment to gather all the Jewish people after every sabbatical year, and during. So this would apply. This would apply to last Sukkot, because that would have been the year after the sabbatical year, and everybody's got to gather there. Okay, let's keep on going.
When would they read? On the day following the first day of the holiday of Sukkot, which is the first day of Chol HaMoed of the eighth year, the king would read so the people would hear. The reading was held in the women's courtyard. He will read while seated. If he read while standing, it is praiseworthy. From which passages in the Torah should he read? He starts from the beginning of the Chumash. These are the words until the end of the passage Shema.
So this is talking about the book of Devarim, Deuteronomy. So it reads the first, let's say, six chapters. Go on.
He then skips to the passage, V'haya im Shemoa, and then...
Which, as you know, is the second paragraph of the Shema.
And then skips to the passage, Asayir ta'asayir.
Right, Asayir, which is the book, which is the Parshas Re'eh, which is roughly chapter 13. Go on.
He then reads from that passage in order until the end of the blessing and curses, i.e. until the phrase, besides the covenant he established with them in Horeb, where he concludes.
Which is basically last week's Parsha, so it's taking up to chapter, I don't know, 26, I think 25, 20. So that's a nice, healthy 13 chapters of reading from that second section. All right, go on.
How is the reading conducted? Trumpets are sounded throughout Jerusalem to gather the people. A large wooden platform is brought and set up in the center of the women's courtyard. The king ascends and sits on it so that they will be able to hear his reading. All of the Jewish people who made the festive pilgrimage gather around him. The attendant of the synagogue would take the Torah scroll and give it to the head of the synagogue. He would give it to the segen, who would give it to the high priest, who would give it to the king. The transfer involved many people as an expression of respect. The king accepts the scroll while standing. If he desires, he may sit when reading. He opens it, looks at it, and recites the blessings like anyone who is reading the Torah in a synagogue. He reads the passages mentioned in the previous halacha until he completes them. He rolls the scroll closed and recites the blessing afterwards as it is done in synagogues. He adds seven blessings.
Okay, go on.
Which are, the reading and the blessings are in the holy tongue, as implied by Deuteronomy 31:11. Read this Torah, i.e. in its wording. This applies even though foreign speakers are present.
Right. In other words, they do it. The king reads it in its original. Reads it in Hebrew, even though that the people don't understand Hebrew. By the way, you should know, in during the Second Temple, most Jews spoke Aramaic, and that was the majority language of Jews speaking through the Second Temple period till the year nearly 1000. And that's why we have the official translation called Unkelis, which they would read one verse in the Hebrew and one verse in the official Aramaic translation. Here, this they would not do it. They would only read it in the original Hebrew. All right, go on.
So in what language did they speak before that?
Hebrew.
Okay. Converts who do not understand are obligated to concentrate their attention and direct their hearing, listening with reverence and awe, rejoicing while trembling as on the day the Torah was given at Sinai.
Ah, okay, good.
Even great sages who know the entire Torah are obligated to listen with exceedingly great concentration.
Let me finish last paragraph and we'll put it all together. Go on.
One who is unable to hear should focus his attention on this reading, for Scripture established it solely to strengthen the true faith. He should see himself as if he was just now commanded regarding the Torah and heard it from the Almighty, for the king is an agent to make known the word of God.
Okay, good. So that basically summarized the event. So just let's put it into chronological order. So how did they gather the Jews to the Temple Mount on the first day of Chol HaMoed? What would be the methodology of gathering the Jews?
The trumpet blast.
Right, they'd have guys going through the town blowing trumpets. It's time to go to the Temple Mount, where to the large Ezrat Nashim, the women's section, which is the largest section in the temple campus, in the mount. All right, and they set up a whole table and a large thing. And platform, and he'd be above them. And then, how would they, in order to make it, to add to the pomp and circumstance, what would they do? What was the feature of the pomp and circumstance?
Bunch of people handing off the Torah.
Anybody? Was it just anybody?
No, the big mouthers in the shul, the attendant, the Kohen Gadol.
Right, basically, the leadership. Those are talking about the people who are basically the Kohanim, who are the major administrators of the temple, and as well as the Sagan is the assistant high priest, and then the high priest, and then he give it to the king. Okay, so what are they trying to bring to mind to the people? What do they want people to feel? Sean.
A certain sense of like awe about the whole process.
Right. So it's equivalent to, if anybody's ever seen, I think they just had a recently Netflix produced a series of the early years of Queen Elizabeth, including the whole process for becoming coronated in 1953, right? And that was, rehearsed with the choirs and the trumpets. They're trying to make it and they made it an entire big spectacle because they were trying to reflect the grandeur and glory of the British Empire is being passed on to a new member of the royalty. Similarly, they're trying to do the same thing here. But the difference is not about trying to coordinate any human king here. They're trying to make the impression on the crowd that what's happening here is of tremendous significance. Why is the king the guy to read? Why is the king given the job to read the Torah? Suzanne.
I'm gonna go with it's a big job. I think it helps bring home the gravity of the task at hand.
Right. He is the leader. He's the leader of the Jewish people. So therefore, he's sort of functioning. What role is he in the Sinai experience? What role is he playing?
Moses.
He's playing the job of Moses. Okay, he's an agent of the word of God. That's what Moses' job was, okay? And why are they reading? It's a little bit of a tougher question, a little advanced question. I'll pick at somebody randomly. Our Moshe Chaim Dodd, why are they reading sections from the book of Devarim?
Because,
which has the Shema and the Ten Commandments. and the Chaim Shemoa.
It goes back to the founding of the Jewish people and the reason that everyone's Jewish and the reason why we're all keeping the mitzvot. And
well, it doesn't go, we're not reading the Exodus story.
No, because it's not about the miracles of God. It's about the daily mitzvot that they're engaged in, the process of establishing them.
Well, what are the, but I mean, not all the mitzvot are in the book of Devarim. Which mitzvot are in the book of Devarim, principally?
In, that's your daily life stuff, isn't it? It's
well, the first six chapters deals with, it has foundational mitzvahs like loving God, fearing God, the idea of foundational mitzvah of reward and punishment, cleaving to God, following in his ways, which we talked about last week. A lot of the foundational mitzvahs to set up the state are being discussed. It's sort of like the core, basically he's reading the core constitution of the Jewish people, which is a major chunk of the book of Devarim. That's what he's essentially reading, which talks about the covenant of the Jewish people and God, and the core mitzvahs that really immediate reflect that. You know what I'm saying? So he's not just doing any part of the Torah, but the mitzvahs that show about the foundational character, relationship between God and the Jewish people, and a relationship with him. So it's really a sort of a summary of the core principles of Judaism. Okay? So why is he doing that?
It's a teachable moment for the people who haven't heard the Torah before. As the verses said, the children who do not know will listen and learn.
Right.
So, it also acts as a refresher for the people who have heard it before. They haven't heard it for 7 years.
Well, we assume that people go to, there is, again, in Judaism, there's reading of the Torah every week, literally every 3 days. So this is not really the goal here is not just so they should have an encounter of learning Torah, because that's a daily mitzvah. Well, here's an interesting question. Let's say the crowd is so big and they didn't have, they did not have sound reinforcement in the time of the Chumash. So it's quite possible that if you got yourself a bad location in the temple there, temple in the Ezra and Nashim, you could not literally hear because you're too far away from the king. So is there any value in that?
Being part of the Jewish crowd of...
My penny.
Yeah, okay, yeah. Amanda, what do you say?
I think it relates back to the football game, right? So like with the 2-year-old doesn't really necessarily understand everything that's going on, but it's this idea that if you're there for the foundation of it, it's something that you carry with you for the rest of your life and also for them into Eretz Israel.
Correct. The man is on point here. In other words, the goal here is it's one part education and two parts experience. It's an impactful moment. Visualize you're in a crowd of possibly, maybe looking sticky. So you're talking about possibly, if you saw the Herodian model, which those were in Israel with me this year or years past, The campus, the major, the women's section, you could easily fit in there, I don't know, maybe 100,000 Jews standing, squished together, right? So imagine you're there in a crowd of 100,000 Jews there for the Sukkot holiday. You're hearing the king read the dramatic sections of the Torah. And whether you could understand or can't understand, you know something big's happening, okay? I mean, the question they ask, because it says you have to bring men, women, and children, and even little children. So the Talmud asks, well, why do you have to bring little children, like a 2-year-old? What's the value of that? So the Talmud gives sort of a little bit of a mysterious answer, and I'll share it with you, and I think it's open to a couple of possibilities. Which Rashi quotes, the answer is, you have to bring your little kids to the Hakel service ceremony it gives you a reward to the parents. The Torah obligated you to bring a child who's not really who's not cognitively able to understand what's being read to provide reward for the parent. What is being, that's a little bit mysterious, and in fact, there's a number of the Mefarshim, the commentators on the Talmud and elsewhere, give possible understandings of that, but I want to hear what you got to say.
It's reward for their parents that they're continuing the tradition and making sure that their children learn the Torah too.
100% correct. In other words, one would naturally think this 2-year-old kid is probably going to have to need a snack and probably going to start to cry and probably need to diaper change and it could be generally annoying and let him stay home with a babysitter, right? Would that thought go through a parent's mind?
Yes.
Right? So notice the parent of such a child whose memory of that age is not so long ago immediately said yes. Correct. 100%. You'll say, and just the opposite, is having the kid there can take away from your experience. You want to pay attention to the dramatic reading, and this little kid's crying. So Shana's point is brought down by a relatively modern commentator from the 19th century, Rabbi Zvi David Hoffman from Germany, who said exactly what Shana said, which is basically to reiterate the mind of the parent that the immersion in a Torah lifestyle has to start young, and even though you've got to deal with the basics with the kid and you might feel resistant to that, it's super, super important. So the parent stretching and doing that, even though that's a little bit annoying or a lot annoying depending on the kid, the parent gets rewarded for that. Give me another idea. Give me another possibility. The parents provide reward for the parents. Give me another possible understanding of that concept.
I mean, there is the mitzvot of chinuch, and
well, the child is really under chinuch age. The child's not 4, 5, 6 years old. He's 2. Even according to one possibility, the child's are still nursing. He's 18 months old. He's a little guy or a little girl.
Oh, does chinuch only start at like 4 or 5?
Well, it starts gradually depending on the cognitive level of the child. Chinuch basically means you share a child a mitzvah when they're able to sort of like know how to do it. You know? But here, there seems to be an obligation to take the child anyways. What's being a very important principle, and I think Amanda earlier alluded to it, but how would you put it in the frame that's a provide reward to the parent?
I think like what I was saying before was that in a way, when you're exposing them from a young age, so they're exposed to it, and when they're exposed to it, then they're more likely to pick up the ways. So it's a reward to the parent. I think like even when you have a baby, there's so much growth that goes in from when he's a newborn to when he's 1 year old. He could be walking. So this idea of that there's just so much growth that goes on when you're exposed from a young age.
100%.
Like you're like a sponge.
100%. And the reward for the parent is the fact that you're really creating a warmth, a love, an interest, an impact with the kid. In other words, if you're a little kid, let's visualize. Let's say you're, you know, those people who travel through the Yudaba Shomron, some of those areas are pretty much are the same it was in the time of the Second Temple. You have little villages and you got vineyards. You're out in the sticks. So you imagine you're living out there as a farmer, you know, you're making your nice, growing your nice vineyard of Merlot grapes to make the high-end wine. So you're not seeing a whole lot of people. And then you come, you know, Sukkot time, there's, you know, the great historian Josephus says that the population of Jerusalem would increase by 400%, close to a million people during the Second Temple times, the end of the Second Temple. So everybody comes crowding in. So a little kid, a two-year-old, he can sense, like, this is a big deal. And then there's the pageantry, and there's the trumpets, and there's this fancy stage, and there's the handing off of the Sefer Torah, and the king is dressed in his finery, and he's reading the Torah, and everybody's paying attention and standing in absolute silence, which is hard to get two Jews quiet, much less 100,000 Jews, and is watching this unbelievable spectacle, and it's going to make an impact. Will the child really understand? No, but you're investing for the future. And from this, the Bali Tosos, which are the school of thought that emerge from the son-in-laws and grandchildren of Rashi in Germany and Western France, they connected this, the idea of that there's a value in the practice of bringing small kids to shul, even if they can't daven. You bring the kid there and you give him a candy in shul. You bring him there and you have him kiss the Torah. You bring him there and he gets a little older, he gets to sing the I Don't Know Long. You know what I'm saying? You ever seen that? It's in every shul in the world. These little kids, and they're running around, and they're making a little bit of a racket. It's a positive thing because you're creating a sense of, provided that it's positive and not a burden, you're creating a connection, because Judaism is not limited to the cognitive intellectual experience. Yes, very important. But really, everybody there in the crowd is having there's a tremendous spectrum of the experience. So the Rambam here points out in Halacha 6, the converts who don't understand, in other words, the person who's, you don't, just because you're a convert, doesn't mean that you know a lot. You just have to accept the Torah. You don't have to be well educated. They got to know that they're hearing the Torah sort of in a certain sense akin to the reenactment of the Sinai. So they're having, you know, they're relating to it purely on emotional terms. And then you got the great sages who know the entire Torah well, who can, you know, explain every single word in a very deep way, are obligated to listen with exceedingly great concentration. Even they, there's room to grow and understand. There's things that even Rabbi Akiva, if he's there, would get an insight. There's, in other words, from the greatest Jew down to the little kid, everybody gains something from the experience. And that's something which is very important for all of us. Even though that we don't sadly have the mitzvah hakel, although there is, by the way, a custom in Israel nowadays to reenact like a little mini hakel. They had it last year, Sukkot. The basic idea is that, first of all, as a parent, it's very important to understand that there's very important for the child to get sort of a positive experiential connection to Judaism. So very simply, and I mentioned this a little last week a little bit. So for example, if you're having guests over for Shabbos, right? So just as you're helping set the table, you want to get your kids involved. You know, give them something to do. If you want them to appreciate Shabbos, you have your kids do a little, join you in the kitchen, do a little cooking. Everybody does a little bit cleaning. You know, go to shul, give them candy, let them say the I don't know lulav. Oh, it's come time for lulav, give them the lulav to shake a little bit, even if they're not fully able to grasp the idea. The goal is to connect the child experientially to all the mitzvot on their level. And what the Torah is endorsing, that there are impacts on the child that that you can't really trace. That's why, going back to our original metaphor of the Detroit Lion who brought his two-year-old son to go there, because he, in his world, the greatest good is participating in participating in the game. What's more important than a professional NFL football? There's nothing more important than that. But for us, Hashem, the Torah, and mitzvah's important. So, but that's not just purely a, you know, right now we're learning, we're reading text, we're asking questions, we're doing a cognitive experience. But what this mitzvah shows you that do not miss the experiential, the emotional features of Judaism. You don't want it to be a dry, clinical, detached experience. You know what I'm saying? And even somebody who's, and even a kid who's 18 months old, 2 years old, 3 years old, 4 years old, there's something for them to enjoy and to participate in. And that's something which was a biblically mandated. The parents had to bring the little kids to the temple. And of course it was annoying, but the person might have, resented that. But the bottom line is that the benefit for the kid was great. And it's not just a one-time deal, obviously, but it's built on upon an attitude of chinuch that you want to nurture positive, warm experiences of Judaism to your child. Now, it's not limited to your child. It's also to you. In other words, you know, Woody Allen said, you know, like 90% of life is just about showing up. There's a truth about that, is that there's a value even if you're going to shul and you're not in the mood, you know, or there's a mitzvah that you're doing that you're not 100% connecting with. There's a value to the experiential dimension. Obviously, you want to marry that with learning, obviously, to not just do the what, but you want to have the why, but not to mitigate the experience. And it's just something that you got to be in it to win it, and you want to experience it. That's really a central message of that. And there's a wide spectrum of experiences, both, you know, cognitive, experiential, emotional, which is all mixed together depending on the person. So from the two-year-old to the greatest sage of Israel, they're all there. They're all there at the grand assembly. And that's true. That's it. So I picked this mitzvah because really it's a great example for all of Judaism. I'll give you a simple example. So when I have little ruler kids, you know, Rosh Hashanah is for somebody who's like 10, it's a pretty boring service, okay? So you got to know how to, you know, take breaks. Some even adults need to take breaks sometimes. But I would always bring the kids in for blowing the shofar, you know? You know, they didn't have to, you know, and they love that. They come in there and they're looking at the guy and they walk into where 2 feet away from the guy holding the shofar, and they're looking at his face, and of course they're checking out if he's turning red, and you know, whatever the world of the 4-year-old, whatever that exactly is. And the kid is hearing what the cold shofar is. But again, that's gonna be a foundational experience that they're gonna draw from when they become much more mature and sophisticated. They have this rich Jewish experience to build upon, to refine and reframe and uplift. And it's not limited to kids, it's adults as well. So you don't want to, the key message here is you don't want to cheat yourself out of the experience, certainly not kids and not adults, because it's a multifarious phenomenon, multi-dimensional experience. And you see that we're doing, basically, the Torah is endorsing theater. The Torah basically tells you we're going to basically create every 7 years, we're going to do a Sinaitic, Mount Sinai recreation. Let's go to why Michael does. Why every 7 years? Because the 7-year cycle is sort of like a new unit of time, a new unit of growth in the Jewish community. We're about to start a new sabbatical cycle. We want to get focused on our constitution. We want to re-experience it in the same way the Jews experienced it, plus or minus, you know, the grandiose sound effects of Sinai, and we want to do that. So that's the main point.
Let me question one more thing on the timing.
Yes.
A, are they doing this like in a giant sukkah as well?
No, there's no, they don't. They have Sukkot in Jerusalem, but there is no sukkah because a Jew is not allowed to sit on the Temple Mount.
Interesting.
And you can't, and you have to go to the mikvah before you go to the Temple Mount, and you can't wear shoes. It's really a solemn experience. That's why the king, only the king, is allowed as a dispensation, since he gets to sit. But it's ideally that even he doesn't sit. Nobody sits. Why? Because if you're talking about a revelation, it would be disrespectful to sit.
Wouldn't this be more impactful at the time of judgment, though, rather than afterwards?
No, because the Jews don't have to come to Jerusalem in Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur time.
Oh, good point.
You know, the goal is not to inconvenience everybody. The goal is to, when everybody's there, you know, let's the first available time after Yom Tov, so after the first day of the holiday, there's no second day in Israel, as you know, they gather all the people and they have a big hakel.
Why have the political leader lead it and not the spiritual leader?
That's an excellent question. So the Ram used the term, he's an agent of God, because part of the mission of the Melech is to fight the wars and to mechazek dat ha'emes, to strengthen the true religion. He has sort of a national responsibility of the well-being. The part of his national well-being is really doing this this activity. Because really, the Torah did not say, just this has to be read, right? But the oral law is that it has to be read by him. Because that really is central. It's part of his portfolio of responsibility, that he's not just a political leader. He is a spiritual leader. He has to be concerned about the military well-being and security, of course, economic, political, and spiritual. Now, of course, he has other people. He's not giving the shear. He may not be able to give the greatest shear. Sometimes it is. King David was all in one. King Solomon was all in one. But his responsibility, this is not about the best insight. This is about the experience around the Torah. It's experiential. It could also have the insight, but that's not critical. Even the person who's out in the outer reach of the crowd, who can't hear it, he's supposed to have in mind, like, I'm trying to recreate the experience. He's just trying to take it all in. He's like in a stadium. He can't really see the nuances of the game because he's got bad seats, you know? Or the convert who's new to Judaism doesn't know that much. He's, you know, newly educated. Doesn't, you know, can't follow all that Hebrew. It's way too much Hebrew. So everybody's got to, you know, that's the experience. That's the idea. And the kids. Don't forget the kids. It would have been an amazing experience. I mean, it's, you know, when you read the description of the Ram, it would have been like a cool experience just to be able to, like, you know, jump into our time machine and go back to, you know, Second Temple times, to be there on the Temple Mount on, you know, the Herodian temple and the extremely large Ezrat Nashim and see this entire episode playing out. It would have been pretty cool. All right, so that's the basic idea. I wanted to share that, but I think it has practical lessons to all of us about really to try to take advantage of not just the cognitive intellectual dimensions of Judaism, but the emotional experiential. Very important. Certainly kids who could only connect to the experiential and the emotional, you got to include them. Or Jews who are Jewishly on a child level. They should also be, you know, embraced. They should experience, you know, that aspect of Judaism, which is, you know, which has that dimension. All right, guys. Have a great Shabbos.
Thank you. You too.
Bye-bye, you too.
See you tomorrow.
Take care, guys.